Thank you. Thank you, Minister Cannon. Sorry, quietly adjust the microphone. Senator Kennedy, it's great to have you here. That's a big name when it comes to politics, and you carry the burden that goes with that name, but I'm told that you're one of the most energetic senators across the United States, and I wish you well. I look forward to seeing you in Ireland later on this year. Ambassador Daniel Hall, thank you for the work that you're doing for Ireland here, for our people here, and for Ireland's continuing reputation, which is so important across this country. To Ciarán Madden, who I know very well, and who is doing a really good job here in New York. Ciarán, thank you for everything that you continue to do. And of course, there are many others here too, the Secretary General from the Department of Foreign Affairs, and a lot of the rest of our senior team as well. This is a big week for us. And to the other leaders in the room of the Irish community in Philadelphia, in New York, and in neighbouring states, thank you for taking the time to be here. It's all remade our event show. And not everyone all come especially with the show that's what you did. So thank you for turning up on a really difficult night, given the chaos that the UN generally tends to cause this week. In terms of traffic, I suspect many of you had to walk for quite a distance this evening. I'd like to just talk to you about a number of things, because I know every time I come to the US and I talk to the Irish community here, it's a reminder just how much you care about what's happening to Ireland and in Ireland, because it's your country just as much as it is mine. And we're embarking in a number of really challenging circumstances and events, but we're also doing things that I think you can be very proud of. The Irish economy this year will be the fastest growing economy in the European Union for the fourth year running. Ireland will be the youngest country in the European Union and the fastest growing population in the European Union. And we have a much more sustainable economic model now, dare I say, than at any point we have had in the past. This government and opposition parties working with us are determined to end the boom and bust cycle that has caused the kind of carnage in Ireland that has driven huge numbers of people to the United States out of necessity, and then try to suck them back as our economy takes off again. We are going to stop that and instead build a much more mature relationship where people can choose to migrate and leave Ireland and come to the shores if they want to for a period of time in their lives, but also have the option to come home when they want to in terms of being able to find an affordable home and a job. And that is, in many ways, the mission of this current government, having helped to steer Ireland on the back of the sacrifice of many Irish people living in Ireland and many Irish people who have driven abroad through a pretty dark recession into now a much more stable and optimistic Ireland, I'm glad to say. And in the Department of Foreign Affairs, we are in expansion mode too. For the first time, we're actually opening end of season consulates. This year, we will open a consulate in Los Angeles. We'll open one in Vancouver. We'll open a new embassy in Santiago in Chile. In fact, our first ambassador to Chile is here with us this evening, Paul Gleason, who's my chief advisor in terms of policy. We're going to open a new embassy in Bogota, in Colombia. We're going to open, we have already opened a new embassy in Wellington, in New Zealand. So we are reflecting the fact that our Irish people and Ireland is a global tribe that has a global outlook. We are global citizens. And so that is the way we view ourselves as a people. And in order to keep pace with that, if we're serious about recognising that as a government, we need to expand also to reach out to that community wherever they are, and to reach out to new communities where Irish people want to be part of solutions and opportunities. And so between now and 2025, we will open about 25 new missions, embassies and consulates in strategic parts of the world where there is not a sufficient Irish footprint right now, but which there will be, because of the money and investments and planning that we are putting into that. This is called our Global Footprint Project. And the Taoiseach and I and Kieran are hugely committed to it, and we are going to put our money where our mouths are in terms of funding that expansion and growth. We will have over 100 embassies and consulates within the next 4 to 5 years. Currently we have less than 80. And so that is a reflection also of the priority that we are trying to give in terms of giving a say and a vote to Irish people all over the world for presidential elections to elect our first citizen, who needs to be someone who doesn't simply represent the island of Ireland or the vast majority of it, but actually a person who represents Irish people all over the world and what we stand for and who we are and where we come from and our culture, our language, our music, and what makes Irish people different to other nationalities wherever they live. And in many ways, as Kieran said, it is the togetherness of events like this evening that are a reminder of what actually marks us out as an individual. Dare I suggest that some of you took the green tie out of the locker for the first time for St. Patrick's Day to turn up this evening to show a little bit of patriotism through your wardrobe this evening. Those of you who are slaves to fashion don't do green. But that doesn't mean you don't feel it. So that's our expanding Department of Foreign Affairs. I'm not sure, I think Niall can confirm this, I don't think there's ever been an expansion plan like we have right now for Foreign Affairs. I think I can safely say also that in terms of our moral responsibility to the poorest parts of the world that have nothing and that rely on the generosity of countries like ours and people like ours, we are going to see a dramatic expansion and increase in the amount of funding that we're going to provide for our development aid program in the years to come. We are committed that by 2030 we will fulfill the commitment that was made some years ago that Ireland will contribute 0.7% of gross national income in Ireland to development aid. To hit that point home, we currently spend about €728 million a year on development aid. By 2030, that figure will be €2.5 billion. That is the extent of the growth, which means an average increase in expenditure every year for the next 12 years of €150 million, euros, which is about $170 million extra each year. For a country in terms of its taxpayers, the size of Ireland, that is a significant commitment that we're going to follow through on. Because if we call ourselves a global nation, if we describe ourselves as a Taoiseach does, as an island at the centre of the world, if we believe in multilateralism, if we believe in organisations like the UN and the EU, which we do, well then, words are cheap if they're not backed up with action and finance. And that is why measuring a country's commitment on the basis of a percentage of its GNI, in my view, gives real credence and credibility to the claims that we make and the arguments that we make around the advocacy for human rights and for a global-based rule, rule-based system that allows small countries, as well as large, to compete with each other on a level playing field. And at a time, quite frankly, when that approach to globalisation is being somewhat challenged, Ireland needs to be courageous and brave in terms of standing up for what has allowed our country to survive and grow and expand at the rate that it has, which is that multilateral approach towards problem solving. And that brings me to Brexit. My responsibility in government is to be our chief coordinator on Brexit and Brexit strategy and Brexit negotiation. I work very closely with the Taoiseach on that and with Minister Helen McEntee and others. And I say that as far as I'm concerned, we are protecting the interests not only of the just under 5 million people in the Republic of Ireland or the other 1.5 million people living in Northern Ireland, but as far as I'm concerned, all Irish people need to know that their government back home is protecting the core interests of our island as a whole, and the relationship that we have with the United Kingdom, which is a complex one, but a hugely important one for all sorts of reasons, while at the same time reinforcing the point that we are not going to travel on the same road as the United Kingdom out of the European Union, because it is not in our interest, and it is not what Irish people want. In fact, in a recent poll, 93% of Irish people now say that they want to stay in the European Union, and for those under the age of 26, 97%, which is virtually everybody in Ireland under the age of 26, realises and understands the importance and the value of Irish membership of the European Union right now. But we have to respect the fact that Britain has made a decision by a very narrow margin to move it in a different direction. What we don't have to respect, though, or what we don't have to accept, is that Ireland will have to deal with a significant negative consequence of Brexit for our own interests and for our own island. And that is why in these negotiations we have been consistent, we have been firm, I think we have been polite and respectful, but we will continue to, if necessary, be stubborn to protect core Irish interests on the island of Ireland. And that is why last December we made it very clear that we would not allow the negotiations to move forward to focus on future relationships and future economic models and so on, unless we got absolute guarantees around the peace process and the border issues on the island of Ireland. And to the British Prime Minister's credit, she gave us those guarantees in writing in a political agreement last December, when she said that if we can't agree through negotiation a way of solving the Irish border question, and the Irish border question means no border infrastructure on the island of Ireland in the future, and she said if that can't be solved through negotiations and proposals, well then the United Kingdom will maintain full alignment with the rules of the EU Customs Union and Single Market in the areas necessary to protect North-South cooperation and all-island economy and the Good Friday Agreement. And that line has subsequently become known as the Irish backstop. And what that means in simple language is that this is an insurance mechanism, so that regardless of what happens in the future negotiations in terms of what economic model we operate to, in terms of how people and goods and services travel between Ireland and the United Kingdom, and the United Kingdom and the rest of the European Union, but actually regardless of the detail of that, there is an insurance mechanism that will be enshrined in the withdrawal treaty in its legal text that will be legally operable, providing that guarantee, and it will remain unless and until something better is negotiated in the future in terms of the trading relationship between the EU and the UK as a whole. And without that guarantee and that fallback insurance mechanism, we will not sign up to a withdrawal treaty for the United Kingdom to leave the European Union. That is understood clearly in Westminster. In my view, Theresa May is trying to deliver on the commitments that she has made, both in December and again in March, when she committed that backstop text would be legally operable and part of the legal withdrawal treaty, which is what we're trying to finalise right now. And for those of you who are interested in the detail, there are two documents that are needed to be finalised between now and the end of the year. In order for Britain to leave the European Union in a way that is managed and predictable and gives businesses and politicians and families the time and space to be able to adapt to the new realities that undoubtedly we will face after Britain leaves the European Union. The first document is this legal withdrawal treaty. And the good news is, it's 90% complete. It deals with four areas. First of all, citizens' rights. There are 3.5 million EU citizens living in the UK, and there are millions of UK citizens living across the European Union. They need to know where they stand after the 29th of March next year. And that issue has largely been settled and agreed. The second issue is what's called the financial settlement. Britain has committed to contribute to EU budgets until the end of 2020. And while some in Britain are saying, once we leave, we're not going to contribute any more to the EU, the issue has largely been settled that until the end of 2020, Britain will contribute about another 40 billion sterling equivalent into the EU budget. The third issue then is perhaps the most important for business and for many US companies in the UK and Ireland, and that is an agreement on what's called a transition period. So after Britain leaves the European Union on the 29th of March next year, without an agreement, the following day will be chaotic in terms of how trade functions. Planes will not be able to take off out of Heathrow to land in Dublin because of certification around safety and so on, which normally gets certified through EU agencies, won't have been done. And so what we need is a transition period to give time and space to negotiate sector by sector what the future relationship will look like. And we've agreed to roughly a 2-year period up until the end of 2020 to do that. And the full EU rulebook applies for that period. In other words, Britain will behave as if it's a member state, except it won't be in the EU political institutions any longer for that period. And that's agreed. And then the fourth and final issue is us. It's Ireland. And on some of those issues, we've got agreement, I'm glad to say. You can break the Irish issues up into three as well. One of them, which many of you, or certainly your families, will have benefited from, which is what's called the common travel area between Ireland and the United Kingdom. So Ireland and Britain have this extraordinary relationship, actually since the 1920s, where not only do they allow free travel within each other's countries, but actually we have a virtual recognition of citizenship in each other's countries. So Irish people can go to the UK, they can work, they can study. I'm a good example of that. I'm in university in the UK, and the British taxpayer pays for my fees. And there are many British people in Irish universities that have the same privilege. They can carry pension rights. Irish people can even vote in British elections, as can British people in Ireland. Not in presidential elections, however, like you'll be able to vote in a few. So that common travel area arrangement will stay intact post-Brexit, when effectively Irish people will have a significant privilege in terms of access and rights in the UK beyond any other EU citizen, because of that common travel area, which both countries are now going to treat on a bilateral basis. The second issue is the Good Friday Agreement. And there are many people in this room who have contributed to making the Good Friday Agreement a reality 20 years ago, and who now want to see it survive, and more than survive. You want to see it as a foundation to actually build a more peaceful and a more content society in Northern Ireland, and indeed a more content society across the border, north and south of the island of Ireland. And we are going to protect the Good Friday Agreement. Let me promise you that. But it is complicated. And it's complicated because we have agreed well over 200 areas of North-South cooperation linked to the Good Friday Agreement structures. At least two-thirds of those function seamlessly because of EU membership of both jurisdictions. Because we operate with the same rule book, in the same customs union, in the same single market, in the same common agricultural policy, in the same common fisheries policy. Doctors get certified on both sides of the border from the same certification body. US pharmaceutical companies produce medicines in Britain and Ireland, both certified by the European Medicines Agency, who may not be able to certify in the UK any longer post-Brexit. These are the complications for Northern Ireland. And let me just give you a very basic example in agriculture. Every year, for those of you who are familiar, because some of you have come from parts of Ireland that are pretty rural, like Bex. Every year, over 100,000 store cattle, that have about another 6 months to go, get purchased from small family farms in upland areas on the west coast of Ireland. And they get taken north of the border by farmers to get finished and slaughtered. Every year, 500,000 lambs produced on Northern Ireland farms come south of the border to be slaughtered. Every year, almost 40% of all milk produced on farms in Northern Ireland gets processed south of the border by our big processors and exported to about 170 different countries. We have a seamless all-island economy that functions, that is a reinforcer of the peace process, that gets unionists and nationalists dealing with each other, not talking about politics, but talking about commerce and normality. And we're going to protect that. And that is why we cannot tolerate the re-emergence of physical border infrastructure that interrupts that kind of normality. Whether it's growing... and believe me, getting that deal done is not easy, because Britain is insisting on leaving the customs union and single market as well as the European Union. And what that essentially means is that if goods travel from one customs union into another, from one single market into another, under international trading rules, there has to be borders. There has to be inspections. And so the only way to prevent those inspections is a political agreement that effectively creates an extension of the single market for Northern Ireland. But the problem with that is that it potentially creates barriers between Northern Ireland and the rest of the United Kingdom, which many unionists fear, understandably. And so Brexit has created a sense of political stagnation and fear and tribalism in Northern Ireland, whereby nationalists look to the government in Dublin for protection and unionists look to London for protection. And the parties have been driven apart, which is why it's 20 months now since we've had devolved government and a functioning Stormont and a functioning executive in Northern Ireland. Much to the regret of many people in this room, and much to my frustration and regret, I can tell you. And Brexit is having a corrosive influence on our efforts to try to correct that and fix it. And that is why, for lots of reasons, we need to get a deal done here. And that is why we are going to get a deal done, in my opinion. The British Prime Minister and her cabinet will publish a new paper, I think relatively soon, on ideas around the legal text of this famous backstop that must be part of the withdrawal treaty. And the EU side is trying to show some flexibility also in terms of trying to de-dramatise any checks that may be required between the United Kingdom and Northern Ireland. To ensure that there is no real interruption to trade or commerce that may undermine the economic integrity of the United Kingdom as a whole, which is something that unionists in Northern Ireland would find very, very difficult to accept under any circumstances. Just like nationalists would find it impossible to accept under any circumstances, new border infrastructure re-emerging on the island of Ireland between where they live and what they regard as their own country. And if you think about the other complexities that we're trying to deal with legally, around the fact that if you're born in Northern Ireland today, or since the Good Friday Agreement, you have a birthright to Irish citizenship, if that's what you consider yourself to be, or British citizenship, if that's what you consider yourself to be, or both, if you want Jewish citizenship. And now we have to factor that into the reality that Northern Ireland, as part of the United Kingdom, is going to be leaving the European Union. Because if you're an Irish citizen in Northern Ireland, you automatically have EU citizenship. But because the Good Friday Agreement doesn't allow for or tolerate discrimination on the basis of identity, if you're a British person in Northern Ireland, you cannot get any less rights as an Irish person in Northern Ireland. And that counts too for the rights that come with EU citizenship. So the irony of this is that I am making the case for hardline unionists in Northern Ireland to get all of the privileges of EU citizenship, even though they want to leave, because of the Good Friday Agreement and its genius and its fairness to both communities. So I hope that I'm giving you a sense of the complexity and the detail and the job and the workload that comes with trying to navigate this stormy water, because that's what it is. And it's created strain between the Irish and British governments. The British political system, and I've lived in the UK for some of my life, I have never seen the British political system in the kind of chaos that it's in right now. Brexit is such a divisive issue for them. In families, in political parties, between political parties, and the political system, for all its strength and history in Britain, in Westminster, is really struggling to deal with the weight of this issue. And of course, Ireland, in my view, can play a positive role here by remaining consistent and firm and honest and respectful, but determined to protect our own core interests and the relationship with the United Kingdom. The outcome that we want is pretty simple, actually. The closest possible relationships with Britain that we can negotiate. No border on the island of Ireland, a protected Good Friday Agreement, and a peace process that starts to function again with devolved government, with North-South institutions, with an executive that is, I hope, all parties, with cross-communities working together. That's what we're working for, and I hope that you will support us in that work as the weeks pass. We're in for a very difficult 6 weeks, in my view, to try and finalise this. Finalising a negotiation and a legal treaty of this complexity is difficult, highly political, but the alternatives to it, in my view, are so negative that we will find a way to get it done. And I'm confident that that will happen. Along with the legal treaty, there's going to be a need for a political statement as well, which points to the direction of what the future relationship is likely to look like, which will be negotiated in terms of detail over the transition period that I talked about earlier. But the real challenge is the legal text, because when you have political declarations and statements, you can sometimes build in some constructive ambiguity that allows politicians to be able to claim victory that sometimes aren't there. But legal text doesn't give you any disclosure, because whatever treaty is agreed, it will be tested in court, and it will need to stand up, and it will need to protect Ireland. And I'm glad to say that the work that our diplomats have put in across the European Union has built a solidarity the likes of which I never thought I would see. There isn't a single country in the European Union of the remaining 27 who is even questioning the Irish border, despite intensive pressure and lobbying for them to do so. And I think in many ways it has reinforced in Irish people's minds the value of EU membership, that small countries do actually matter, and that big countries protect them when they're in the same union. And most countries in the European Union take a fairly simplistic approach, actually, to the Irish question. They say to me, well, look, it's as simple as this, Simon. You're staying, they're leaving, we're with you. And that's an understandable human response. I don't want in any way to sound anti-British. There isn't an anti-British bone in my body, quite frankly. Much of my family have grown up and have worked in the UK. Britain needs to be a close friend as well as a close neighbour. And we need seamless trade, and we need close politics to ensure that the responsibility that both Britain and Ireland has, particularly to Northern Ireland, is one that we work together on constructively to make sure that people there can look forward to a much better future than their parents have to live through over the last 30 or 40 years.